Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. We are joined today, first of all, by the MacArthur Award-winning historian, Christopher Beckwith. Chris is the Professor of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, and he specializes in Asian language studies, linguistics, and in the history of Central Eurasia. His books include Empires of the Silk Road, A History of Central Eurasia from the Bronze Age to the Present, which won the 2009 Prose Award of the Association of American Publishers for Best Book in the category World History and Biography Autobiography, Warriors of the Cloisters, The Central Asian Origins of Science in the Medieval World, and his latest work, Greek Buddha, Pyrrho's Encounter with Early Buddhism in Central Asia. And this is going to be the topic of our talk today. We are also joined by the philosopher and chair of the society, Robert M. Ellis, who is no stranger to the podcast. He's recently written a review of the book, and he's here to join Christopher in discussion about it. Hello, Chris. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thank you.
And hello, Robert. Welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, well, Chris, could we start by you telling us a bit about your background, how you became interested in Central Eurasian studies, and what prompted you to write this particular book?
Okay. Well, my interest in Central Eurasia goes back a long way. But basically by reading a book my mom had got from the library, and I was home from Taiwan. I was studying in graduate school already in Chinese literature. Okay. And I read this book, and I thought, wow, I want to find out more about that. I looked into that topic. And I was already applying to graduate school, and I found this strange department where they sort of specialized in things like that. Just by accident, I found it. So instead of applying to a Chinese department, I applied to that one. And that was the one which is now the department that I'm working in. It was the only place you could study that in those days, Central Eurasia. It was the only, there were places you could study it in the Soviet Union, actually. And I think there was one place in Germany that you could study it. But it wasn't a formalized program as it was at Indiana. So I ended up doing that. But my interest in philosophy goes back. I've never been, up until recently, ever really did any serious work on philosophy. I got interested in it when I was in college. I took a philosophy course. Yeah. And the professor had one lecture on skepticism, classical Greek skepticism, and which was basically the teachings of Sextus Empiricus in his preserved works. But I thought, oh, that sounds good. I was mostly bored in that class, and some of the things I just could hardly tolerate. But I mean, I liked the ancient Greek stuff. But anyway, so I immediately went to the library and read the complete works of Sextus Empiricus, and I thought, this is fabulous stuff, you know. So, and I was also studying Chinese, so I took a class in Chinese philosophy, and I wrote a paper on Taoism, comparing Taoism with skepticism, as I describe in my acknowledgments, I think. And I thought that was very interesting and somehow similar to, you know, this kind of Taoism was similar to classical skepticism. And I didn't pay really much more attention after that. I was sort of vaguely interested in Taoism and vaguely interested in classical skepticism and purism, actually. And so I let it go. And then periodically, because I ended up studying as my major language for my doctorate, I ended up studying Tibetan because it just happened to be the teacher was the best teacher. And he was fantastic, and he was a pioneer in Tibetan studies, and he was a great teacher. And the language is just so strange, so amazing, you know. It's just totally backwards and upside down from everything else you know. And it was just a great language. And so and it had a beautiful writing system and a long tradition. I thought, well, this is cool. I got to study this instead of what I was thinking of studying at that time. And of course, doing Tibetan studies, you get exposed to a lot of Buddhism. Most Tibetan literature is Buddhist. The early stuff isn't. But about the most of it, the vast majority of it, is Buddhist. And of course, it's a late form of Buddhism. So I got exposed to it. I had read more here and there, worked on things here and there connected to Buddhism, and never really focusing on it much until I was working on my, I think it started when I was working on Empires of the Silk Road, the history of Central Eurasia. And I had to go read all this stuff. You know, I'm not a specialist. You can't be a specialist in everything, yeah, by definition. So I had to read a lot of other people's works in order to, and incorporate my understanding of their fields, their specializations, into this survey of this 4,000 years of history and a vast territory. So while doing this, I read a lot of things, and somehow, I don't know, in the middle of that, I think I got interested in Pyrrho again, or Pyrrhonism. Yeah. And I read something, I think. Probably it was, I'm not sure it was Richard Betts' book right away, but Richard Betts' book on Pyrrho, or an early Pyrrhonism, which is probably still the best thing written on early Pyrrhonism. I don't agree with his interpretation. He takes the dogmatic, the view that Pyrrho was a skeptical, was a dogmatic, a metaphysician.
Yeah.
So he's mainly interested in metaphysics, and it was a dogmatic sort of thing ultimately. Anyway, so I liked the book, and at some point I thought, okay, I got to look into this some more. And so I had to read the texts, the main texts, there aren't very many, and analyze them. And as I was doing that, I just got more and more into it and wrote a long article on the main texts and in Greek, and then I decided to, I got a grant to go to this institute in Germany, in Bochum, which is a comparative religious history institute, and I spent a year there. And while doing that, I wrote the first manuscript, the draft manuscript of this book. And that was partly helpful because there was so, in Germany, I don't know if you're familiar with sort of the German approach to a lot of fields in what we would call the humanities. They call them human sciences. Mm-hmm. Their approach is very often very theoretical, what we would consider extremely theoretical. I know a lot of people in America now, in North America, are tending in that direction too. But their kind of theoretical approach is really quite different. So it's very hard for me to wrap my mind around it. I've been in Britain. I've given lectures at Oxford and at SOAS. I never ran into that sort of a perspective, really. Oh, I've seen it in print. I've read it. And I thought, what are they saying? I can't quite get it. But so by doing this, having to deal with it on it, and actual workshops and conferences and present things, forced me to think in a different way. And so you somehow get outside your own, out there, and you're over there somewhere and thinking about it in a different way with a new brain. And that really had an effect on this book. I don't think there's anything specifically that I can point to in there, but it was just the way that it made me think, except possibly chapter 4. So some aspects of chapter 4, and I presented my first discussion of circular logic in there in a conference paper, and nobody could understand what in the world I was talking about. So of course, if you change the terms completely, I mean, just not just the language, but the logic behind everything, then where are you? You have to try. I'm not sure I can still wrap my mind around that idea, but that's got to be the way. That's where it is, and that's the way we are. So if that's the way we are, we should try and understand the way we are.
Sure,
but yeah. It seems like nobody's really interested in that. They just want to stick to that old rectilinear logic, Aristotle and all that stuff. So, but anyway, so that was kind of to get us from the back to the present. I should just mention that. In my studies and my research and most of what I do a lot of work on involving different Asian languages, mostly Asian languages, but of course also using Greek material and so on. And I do focus a lot on Central Eurasia per se. I mean, this book doesn't really, it's just borderline. I mean, Gandhara actually, which is probably where Pyrrho was. Well, certainly that's where he was. It was in Gandhara, but that's probably the place where he picked this up, this teaching. And almost certainly, I would say, but I'm not going to say certainly anything. a discussion of this sort. But anyway, yeah, it's pretty clear from all the that's what the evidence tells us, you know. But anyhow, basically, I mostly deal with Central Asia and the steppe zone and history and linguistics. And I just finished another long article, which I sent out a few days ago, about this Central Eurasian thing. Concept and a word that actually made its way into East Asia, another one. I talked about, published an article last year about the word for monastery, which I even knew in this part that you talked about right and left brain in your review. Well, it must be something like that, because in one part of my brain there was this sort of Central Eurasia and East Asia kind of focus sort of thing, and then the other side there's this Middle East and Europe kind of focus sort of thing, and I've worked on both. And I know terms, I mean, in Arabic and in Persian on that side, and then Chinese and Japanese and so on that side, and some of the Central Eurasian languages in there. And I wrote this one all about Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Jurchen, which is the Manchu is actually later Jurchen. So these languages, which belong to different families, and their word for Buddhist monastery. And I thought I'd figured that out. That was back in 2010, I think, that I published that, an article on loanwords, and I just let it sit. And then 2 years later, clung, this side turned on, hey, hello, you know, I'm over here too, you know, or whichever side it was, I don't know, and said, you know, the word for monastery, you know, in the Near East, you know that word, duh, I was reading something, and then there it was, oh, that's the same word. It's an Aramaic word.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the word for monastery, for Christian monastery, all throughout the Near East, it's dair, or something like that, dair. And it goes back to this Aramaic word. Well, that's the word. So they didn't borrow vihara. Vihara is not the word for monastery, a Buddhist monastery or any kind of monastery in East Asia. It's this Aramaic word. Well, how did that happen? Central Asia. They used it. Yeah, Aramaic, Imperial Persian Aramaic. Okay. That's where it's coming from, the word, you know, and now the idea that monastery must come from Central Asia. So that was the kind of, that's the kind of thing that I do. It's give you a sample. Right. So I don't want to, I had one like about this sort of thing forever. So let's not talk about it anymore. That's the
it's
basic.
It's fascinating
idea.
To see those connections though. And also I was interested in what you did with Lao Tse and the linking it to the name for the Buddha. It's,
oh, yes, yes, yeah. Yes.
And obviously, I imagine it's fairly speculative, but just the way you managed to make those links was very
innovative. Okay, well, Chris, could we... I know you can only give a snapshot in sort of 10 minutes or so, but could you make an attempt to give us an overview of the book?
Okay, sure. I thought about it a little bit. I looked at the book. I haven't looked at it for a while, but... Basically, and I mentioned the title, you mentioned in your review, Greek Buddha is a misnomer. It's not. It's actually referring to Pyrrho.
Ah, right.
Uh-huh, yes. Yeah, so that's why I never thought that somebody would interpret it as possibly meaning that the Buddha was Greek or something, but it was simply, I mean, Pyrrho was a Greek.
Yeah.
And he, you know, became kind of an enlightened being, you might say. And his teachings were the same teachings basically as taught by the Buddha. I mean, the earliest, the ones we can figure out on the basis of the data. So that's why I thought
that
of this.
That really didn't occur to me that it referred to Pyrrho, because he's, well, obviously he's presented as a follower of the Buddha, isn't he? Well, and he's not mm-hmm. presented particularly as an enlightened. Yeah.
Well, he's not really presented that way anywhere except in right things that are being written today, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Here, yeah. Yeah. And this is, by the way, a Gandharan sculpture. So it's a Greco Indian art specifically. That's the style. Gandharan art is specifically a mixture of Greek and Indian stuff. And so I thought, and as a young guy, that's a great picture. But that was the. Thing that my original focus for it was okay if what I'd read, you know, what I was thinking about, looking into the material and everything like that, if his teachings were basically Buddhist, well, what kind of Buddhism was it? It wasn't the kind of Buddhism that you see in you know about the periodization of the actual texts that we have. The actual oldest texts we have are these Gandhari manuscripts that were found fairly recently in. The area between border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and those mountains in there. There are some monasteries where there were some deposits were found. And they're in this Prakrit language, so it's an early Indic language, but not Sanskrit. And there are several big international projects working on preservation and this transcription, translation, study of all these texts. There's the biggest one is in Munich. There's one in Oslo, I think, Seattle, Washington. And there's another one I'm not thinking of. But anyway, those are the main ones. So when you look at those texts are very similar doctrinally to what's in the Pali Canon. But all of this stuff is reflecting some very late developments, apparently. And there's indications of that just in those texts themselves, the way they present themselves. So I thought, well, okay, if we have this other material, which we do have some of, Megasthenes is very important, and Puro, assuming that's correct, you know, then what does that say? Well, and there's also the Chinese information. There is, I wouldn't say Taoism is a kind of early Buddhism, even the early Taoism, but it has these early Buddhist elements in it. It's very clear. Some of them are very specific markers kind of early Buddhism. And the name Gautama, that's the name, the actual name of Laozi is not Laozi, it's Lao Dan, which if you go back to the linguistics like I do, then it's reconstructable as Gautama. Gautama, that's the Prakrit form of the name Gautama. So the name is there. We got some things, some ideas. So that's another a testimony. So we have several testimonies kind of from different directions on what these teachings were like probably a century or two after the Buddha's time. And so I've tried figuring out then to what extent, you know, Puro's teachings accord with what we can get from other sources. I mean, the earliest texts that we do have, which aren't very early, but anyway, those are the ones we have. And other testimonies like from the Chinese or from whatever. And whether they're confirmed by Megasthenes. Well, Megasthenes basically confirms it all, what we can get from Puro. But he also gives us a lot of information about Brahmanism and about all these other you know, systems that were going on in India, Gandhara, when he was there. So then that had to be sorted out. So it sorts that out. And then one of the other sources of information, which I neglected a minute ago, is the earliest inscriptions in India, the Mauryan inscriptions. They're usually called the Ashokan inscriptions. And I explain that, in fact, there are two sets they're self-marked pretty much. Some of them call themselves, they're authored by somebody who calls himself Devanampriya Priyadarshi. That's this long Indian title kind of name. And that's the ruler's name. And he's erecting these imperial inscriptions during this dynasty, which was underway at the time Megasthenes was there, actually. He was there to negotiate a treaty with Chandragupta, the founder of that dynasty. Anyway, a couple of generations after Chandragupta, one or two, depending on how we're not sure, this guy named Devanampriya Priyadarshi, who cannot be equated with the names of anybody in the Greek sources, so we just don't know exactly who it was, but it was one or two generations after, and because we have dates in those inscriptions that tell us, dates of other people, other people's names are there, and if you use those names, historical people, then you can identify, well, this had to have been written at the time those people were alive because it says so. So then you can tell. So that puts it in the early 3rd century, 270s, something like that, between 270 and 250.
Sorry, if I could just interrupt you, Chris. You're telling us a lot about the process that you went through, the thinking process, which is interesting. I'm sure anyone who reads the book will be read the book will be interested in that. But what struck me more reading the book was the extraordinary conclusions you've reached. I'm thinking maybe it would be easier for people to relate to if we work back a bit more from those conclusions. I mean, for example, that the Buddha was a Scythian to start with. I mean, that what you've just said about Laozi or that the Buddha wasn't born in the Ganges Valley. I mean, these are all astonishing things for most people who've studied Buddhism. Did you have a sense while you were researching and doing this that you were actually producing something, you know, so radical in a sense, or something completely revisionary?
No, I never set out to produce anything radical. What I'm only interested in is solving the problems, solving the puzzle, and making things as clear as possible, and improving knowledge and improving understanding of things. That's really what I'm always interested in. And people think because I do that, then you have the edifice that has been erected by people over sometimes a very long time. And that one says such and such, things are X. Well, I look at the data, and the data is what you have to look at, and the data can't be interpreted in the way to give you X. So instead it gives you Y. So then I said, let's look at the data and then see what we get. And we get Y, and I describe Y. And I'm not really interested in X very much, unless there's information in the X, some of X, which is relevant. So you mentioned things such as Buddha. Well, his name, his epithet, Shakyamuni, is the Sanskrit form of the oldest form is Shakyamuni. And it just, even either way, it still means sage of the Scythians. The Sakas are, it's just another word for Scythian. It is the same word, by the way. It's the Eastern pronunciation of the word Scythian. What is another one? You mentioned he undoubtedly came from the area of Gandhara, not from Magadha. He may have gone to Magadha, may have worked there, taught there, died there. That's cool. I'm fine with that. It doesn't make any difference, really, where. But it doesn't make sense for him to have come from there in that he had to have had contact with or exposure to Zoroastrianism in order to be able to react against it the way he did. It's very clear that he's reacting against specifically Zoroastrian ideas, or by the way, early Zoroastrian ideas. If you look up Zoroastrianism, I've just been early this morning, I was looking at a recent book on Zoroastrianism, and it's just full of this, well, late Zoroastrianism, shall we say. And it's talking about the Zoroaster and the early stuff, but it's all couched in this late Zoroastrian understanding of everything, and scholars' theories and so on. And if you look at Buddhism, you will get the same thing. It's always the attempts to understand early Buddhism are all seen through the eyes of a very late Buddhism, in fact. And so that's why I tried looking at the earliest sources. That's the reason for my methodology. And that was why I was trying to explain about the inscriptions, that the so-called Ashokan inscriptions, some of them are good. They provide good information, very early information, those ones by David Nampriya Priyadarshi. The other ones that are explicitly Buddhist are very late, much later. They're by somebody else. They don't say they're by Devanampriya Priyadarshi. A couple of them say they're by Ashoka. And so those have to be separated out. So the whole story, the tradition about Ashoka, all that stuff, I'm sorry, it's even more revolutionary, in fact, than what I say about Shakyamuni. Other people have said Shakyamuni means Scythian sage.
Yeah. I mean, you put a lot of store on datable documents, don't you? That it strikes me that your historical case is very much based on the idea that datable documents are reliable and undatable ones are at least much less reliable. I mean, could you say more about why that's an important part of your method?
It's a historical method. History is the study of human events or human things over time. So chronology is of a crucial importance. The oldest sources on things, not always guaranteed to be the best. Sometimes you'll have a late one, which is actually a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy that goes back to an even older one. Okay, the case of Eusebius, the text on Pyrrho, the best text, is preserved in Eusebius's introduction to the gospel. Well, that's kind of a couple centuries AD. And then we go back, it's a copy of another text by Timon, which is in reporting what it's, it reports a historical history of philosophy, which quotes Timon, who's quoting Pyrrho. So we got, you know, four moves. But yeah, that's the problem. But that has been studied a lot. And so we've got that pretty well narrowed down, and we know what it is, where it's coming from, and each of those bits of information. And so when you take the canon, for example, or the canons of Buddhism, and look at the canonical literature, there are all kinds of things there, and people have been trying to figure that out for a long time. What are the oldest texts? You know, what are the oldest teachings, and so on. And I have to respect that to some extent. So I've looked at the best scholarship there and to see what they say. Luis Gomez, for example, and you know, Greg Chopin, and scholars like that who are very critical and looking at the way. What does it say? What do the texts say? You know, what do they tell us? When does this text date to? And Greg Chopin comes to the astounding conclusion, it's inescapable, that the Vinaya isn't earlier than the 5th century A.D. There's no the Vinaya, as we have them, the Vinayas. There are several Vinayas. But they are not earlier than that. They're even dated, some of them. That doesn't mean that there wasn't something like the Vinaya, you know, the Pratimoksha and so on, like that goes back pretty far. But the Vinaya, as we have them, are very late.
So what are you going to say to more traditional-minded Buddhists who will, mm-hmm. I mean, they rely on the idea of an oral tradition, don't they, and the idea of there being reliability in the oral tradition. So would you discount that?
No, not at all. And by the way, I point this out specifically in here, that I'm not for or against any religious system, and I think that all religions have something to teach us, and there's good in all of them, mm-hmm. and that religions, like everything else, human, changes over time. It all changes. Does that mean it's bad? I don't think so. I mean, it's just the way it is. Like Buddha said, you know, all things change, so it just changes, and so I'm sure there's a lot of good things in contemporary Buddhism. I don't know much about it, but things that are, you know, good and admirable and worthwhile. And I just happen to be, because of my approach to things, is I find a problem and then I narrow zoom in on that thing, and I try and use everything I can, everything that I have in my hands, in my brain, to try and solve those problems. And that's linguistic, it's logic, it's you know, historical experience and reading texts and so on.
But if the Pali Canon is not, as you sort of intimate in the book, a reliable guide to the life and times of the Buddha, it does mm-hmm. beg the question how reliable a guide it is to his thought and practice.
Yeah. There are, the thing is, the Pali Canon is gigantic, right? The Chinese Buddhist canon is gigantic. I've worked on that. I haven't worked that much on the Pali canon, but I dabbled in it. The Tibetan Buddhist canon, there's a huge collections of thousands of works, and they're dated all over the spectrum. Some of them are fairly old. Some of them are fairly new.
Yeah.
Many in between. And so they're all different. Some of them have bits in them which are useful, and the scholars have said, well, look, this bit here, This is one of the oldest bits, and it's attested this way, it's talked about that way, it looks like it's pretty old. So when I'm looking at the things in the Greek material, or the Chinese, or the early Indian inscriptions, and I'm trying to understand them, then I look for things that, okay, what is this? How does it show up in the canon? Okay, that's how I'm doing it. I'm not starting with the canon, which is just, you can't start with it. I mean, it's just nobody does. It's just too gigantic. Unless you're saying, okay, I'm going to deal with the organization of it. You know, all right, that's fine. People do that. And then they talk about the titles and which sets things go on, which set and so on, which basket. I don't find that particularly interesting myself. So I'm using the canon, you might say, as additional data to be examined to help figure out what was going on. And while doing that, that's when I became interested in early Buddhism. Before that, I wasn't particularly interested in it. It was because I was trying to figure out what was going on with Pirro's ideas especially, but also what Megasthenes says, which is very interesting. I wanted to find out. So that's how I got involved in using the text. So I think in that recent posting on your site, there was somebody who criticized, quoted a criticism from a Buddhist scholar, Buddhologist. I expect there will be a lot of that, so I don't really have any response. I'm not a Buddhologist. I mean, I'm not a Buddhologist, somebody who specializes in comparing Buddhist texts and studying Buddhist texts per se for their own sake. I have a lot of colleagues who are. I read things. I've reviewed stuff on this and so on, so I'm familiar with it. But I'm not interested in that particularly myself.
Yeah. Okay. So what sort of responses have you had from colleagues who are Buddhologists?
I've had mostly pretty positive ones. I mean, the people who have negative responses to it are not too likely to write to me and say, hey, I read your book and I thought it really was terrible. You know? So the comments that I've gotten either during the manuscript stage or since, have mostly been supportive, and a lot of people have said good things about it. So a little bit better than I expected, actually.
I mean, what I found particularly interesting about your book is that it meshed or provided a historical explanation for a new historical light, if you like, on a problem I've always had with Buddhist teachings and the consistency mm-hmm. of Buddhist teachings. So you place the early teachings of the Buddha, which are compatible with Pirro. You know, that's early Buddhism, as I understand it, as you're presenting it. And then the overall message seems to be that the later, the things which are often seen as core Buddhist teachings, such as the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, Karma and Rebirth and so on, that these are, several centuries later than the than the time of the Buddha as you trace him. And so for me, the issue has always been, in these inconsistencies in the Buddhist teaching, that on the one hand, you've got the early teaching, which is basically the middle way, which rejects metaphysics and avoids metaphysics. Mm-hmm. And then you've later on, you've got all these Buddhist teachings which appeal to metaphysical authorities, which come from the revelation from the enlightenment of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
So, there seemed to be a contradiction, and I couldn't find a historical explanation for that, but you seem to offer one. So that's what's particularly interested me for that. But I mean, did you have that sense when you were writing the book that you were resolving an issue in the teachings of Buddhism, the contradiction that you found there?
That came to my mind, but I was really interested in getting rid of the problems. That's what, to me, one of the problems, one of the things that it distracts from the core topic. So this is just, it's irrelevant. And by the way, some Buddhologists have long ago concluded that the Four Noble Truths is a late teaching. The Eightfold Path is a late teaching. So they're sort of systematized things. So one of the giveaways of that, but that they are in fact much later than what I'm calling early Buddhism. So I just went with that too. And I said, well, they say that too. So out it goes. But it doesn't make any sense, as you said, absolutely right. And I was aware of that. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
So do you think that does that have any implications for Buddhism? For example, do you think that Buddhists need to recognize this contradiction, for example?
I don't know. I mean, like I said, religion changes. All kinds of, every kind of human endeavors and human ideas, all of these, they all change. So I think it's just part of Buddhism today to have these, worlds and, mandalas and all that stuff, the conceptualization of the universe. Some people find it very interesting, and I can see how it's attractive to find it interesting and maybe appealing. And so it's fine with me, but it doesn't seem to have really anything to do with the early teachings, which are where Buddhism is coming from. And they're still there in Buddhism. And I believe that that's one of the core features of Buddhism to this day. It's just simply a continuation of those early teachings, but there are all these other things that have come up. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure to what extent that I would want to pay attention to that if I were really focused on those basic, I guess, the basic teachings.
There's an issue here, particularly I think for more secular minded Buddhists, maybe secular Buddhists as often call themselves, that the compatibility with science it'll be easier to, for example, to reconcile Pirro's teachings as you present them as early Buddhism with a scientific perspective than it is to reconcile Karma and Rebirth, for example, with that scientific perspective.
Right. I think that it does simplify things. And I'm interested in the science, as you may know from my other book, Warriors of the Cloisters, which is very much focused on what Buddhists were doing in those monasteries, and it turns out to be very interesting so far as science is concerned, but nobody ever noticed that before. So far, nobody else seems to be studying it. And it's just, I put it out there. You would think somebody was, I say, look, nobody's worked on this text. We don't have any treatment of it at all. The earliest ones. I mean, why not, they're sitting there in the Chinese canon, in the Taisho Tripitaka. Well, why doesn't somebody work on it? No. So, I don't know. So, I do my best.
So, what do you think what do you get from that in relation to scientific method today?
Yes. It is the ancestor of what we call the traditional scientific method. That's what it was. They were doing it, but they were arguing that's what people do a lot in these academic, what became an academic institution. the monasteries, the monastic colleges. So they argued, debated about things, and in a particular way. And they did it in this unusual way, which developed and became this, what's known as the scholastic method. It used to be known as the scholastic method in Western European medieval studies, the method used by Thomas Aquinas, that kind of thing, for arguing with listing arguments and arguments against arguments and so on. And it turns out to be extremely interesting. So I got interested in the argument and how it works and the logic behind it, and recursion, that sort of thing. But it comes from the Buddhists talking about Buddhism.
Would you say that the provisionality found in the best scientific investigation is
provisionality?
So maintaining a provisional perspective, uh-huh, which can be revised in the light of new evidence.
Uh-huh.
Is that part of what you discovered in these texts?
That's certainly coming from studying the material that went into Greek Buddha. Yes, and my further thought about it and working on Hume, of course, and what he was getting at as a Pyrrhonian, a self-proclaimed Pyrrhonian. And what that means for science. And what it means is that he actually thought there was still a problem there. And as Sextus Empiricus kind of thought there was a problem, because everybody is raised with the same kind of idea, since Aristotle anyway, before Aristotle, but I can't blame him. I like Aristotle. But anyway, with the idea of what I call rectilinear logic and traditional logic, which is not mapped on our world, which is, as Einstein said, curved. I like that idea. But I mean, our logic is circular. Our its induction is in, we can't think without it. We think that way. So if we work on it from that point of view, then we end up with a different approach to science. So that the science, as I mentioned in chapter 4, that things have to be there. It's an imperfect world. So because it's imperfect, it's gradable. It's not all the same. It's not just one perfect thing. There are lots of different things of the same variety. We categorize them. We put those categories on, as Pyrrho said, and it's, according to traditional logic, that's wrong. It makes it circular. We put the categories on, then we think about it, and we use those categories to interpret it. It's completely circular. But all of our thinking is like that. So our logic is fundamentally circular or non-rectilinear. So that's why I call it the vice of circular logic. How do we think? But when you apply that to science, then the scientists are doing this and excusing themselves, saying, oh, sorry, yeah, I know it doesn't. It's not justifiable by philosophy. Science is not justifiable. We're doing it anyway because we want to find out, like Aristotle. We want to find out. We want to find out. He had his own logic, which is rectilinear. But he was mainly interested in just finding out how things worked. You know, that's what he was. So he was trying to analyze it in the best way he could, which was maybe not the best way, but the scientists are doing it. They're doing it in their way, and they are, you know, aware to the extent, to some extent, that yeah, it can't be perfect, and we're going to do the best we can. We get the best measurements we can. It's not the best, not perfect measurements, but they're the best ones we can, and collect as many as possible because we know that some of those are going to be bad anyway. Yeah, and so when you apply that logic to it, then say, wait a minute, what they're saying is it's not all wrong and it's not, you know, unjustifiable. In fact, it's simply normal way of thinking. What Hume said, you know, his what did he say, skeptical solution, which is kind of a cop-out sort of thing. Well, we just live anyway, you know, according to the phenomena. Yeah, what else do we have besides phenomena? I mean, okay, maybe there's something. If you push hard enough on these atoms in the air, you know, you'll find them. They'll be little hard, round, smooth things, you know, and they'll be really there. It really exists for, you know, imperfectly. It's you know, it's a God atom or something. I don't know what people have in their minds, but in fact, we don't have anything like this. Everything is just what we. I'm talking to you. I think that I'm talking to you, and I think I'm talking to you, and you think you're listening to me, and we think about these things, and we think we see all this world. It's just phenomena, and if you try and get beyond that, that's what Pyrrho was criticizing, and I think the Buddha too, is saying, okay, what we think about the world and what we do about the world, that's one thing. He's saying, you know, thinking about the world, taking it one step removed or two steps removed, that's a meta theory, and meta theory is doubly bad, you know, in a sense, because it's just using the results that we get usually from rectilinear logic and end up going through the circular vice, you know, ending up with nonsense, pretty much. It doesn't make any sense. So that's why it doesn't make sense, and that's why he's able to disprove all of it. But then it makes us – I would really want to know. I'm not a logician. I would really like to know what a logic based on non-rectilinear logic – I spoke to a logician that I know, the only one I know, and we discussed it. And it turns out somebody used – nonlinear. I wanted to use nonlinear. Oh, it's already been used by somebody. Computer science. It's being used now. So I can't use it. That term is taken. Okay. So how about rectilinear, non-rectilinear? Okay. It's longer, but that's what it is. And that's the way we think.
Could we characterize that differently? I mean, rather than thinking of it in terms of logic, is it not also at least a question of cognitive bias or of a tendency to go around positive feedback loops, confirmation bias? Mm-hmm. So that we assume that our deductive logic is perfect. But that's surely about the way in which we use logic rather than needing to actually completely change the logic.
Yeah, you're right. There is this problem of the assumption. And again, assumptions are often the things, including logics. The idea used to be that formal logic and pure mathematics, it was some kind of, like God thought, you know, it was perfect. It was perfection. That it didn't have the problems that you had with induction and other kinds of thinking. Mm-hmm. And people who do logic don't accept that anymore. It's all based on induction too. He pointed it out. He's perfectly right. Yeah, we can't do without induction. And what all of the categories and everything that we have, half of them are acquired categories. The others we were born with. So we didn't, you know, they're nothing. Objective, as you say, nothing perfectly objective about any of those. So I am aware of the fact that you mentioned in your comments you thought that maybe that I actually support Pyrrhonism or Pyrrhonian approaches myself. I don't not support them. Some of my ideas, from talking about the circular logic and so on, obviously accord very well with them. As somebody said, he's actually doing philosophy. You know, as a criticism. Well, if you're trying to figure out a philosophical problem, how can you not do philosophy? That's my understanding. It doesn't make any sense to me. So I just, you know, what can we say about that? But you said that you thought maybe I was like a typical sort of Orientalist who was actually quite contemptuous of his subject matter and wouldn't dream of taking any of his Eastern stuff seriously. And so I know I'm definitely nothing like that. And
because that was, if I could just explain that, that's because the first three chapters are so precise and dry, absolutely just about the scholarship. You know, nothing that indicates anything of your perspective on it.
No, I think that it was, from my point of view, in order to make to write chapter four. Actually, I'd already written a draft of that years before. Put it aside and couldn't use it right at the time being. And I ended up completely redoing it from scratch almost. But I'd worked on this idea before. But while working on it, it didn't really connect in my mind while I was working on most of the book. In order to be able to draw some sorts of conclusions and to be what can we do with this, you know, how can we use this? And from any point of view, including a religious point of view, I would really like to understand something about how those texts, what they're really saying, you know, what is that, you see text that's copied over so many times, ends up in Eusebius, what's it really saying? Well, I couldn't agree with what anybody said. I had to do it myself, and then I found out there are mistakes in it. You know, there are one mistake, a textual error in it that nobody caught. And it was simply, if you read a little bit more Eusebius, there it is. Oh, that's why it doesn't make sense. You know, aphasia, the problem of aphasia. There is no aphasia in that text at all. It's, you know, just not there. But you needed to get those things right. And that's one of the things that you learn when you work if you do serious historical work. You need to make sure you examine your texts and get them the best you can before you try and draw any conclusions on it and use all the different sources. So I do that. But what I was going to get to this is that you said you suggested it's about the middle way. The chapter is about the middle way. It's not really about the middle way exactly. In a way it is, but it's really about trying to understand the way Pyrrho was and Pyrrho and the Buddha, Pyrrho and Hume were thinking about these problems. And so the middle way is a solution, you might say, that the Buddha comes to, and I think Pirro and Hume kind of come to the same, pretty much the same sort of conclusion.
I think they're going to disagree with you slightly. That I think the middle way is a method rather than a solution.
Yes, a method, exactly, a practice, a method, yes. I was going to say the same thing, that yes, in fact, it's a kind of method. And you mentioned here something about a doctrine and other doctrines. No. It's not the middle way. It wasn't a doctrine. It was definitely a method, a way of getting to some solutions. And because if it's difficult to teach something directly, how are you going to teach it? Well, if you do it indirectly in some way so that the other person can come to that understanding themselves. So what the old meaning of induction really was, you know, that, you know, Plato's sense of it. So, that's how they're trying to do it, is to provide a method. If you follow this method, you do the sort of, so Buddhist seems to me pretty obvious that, well, I figured it out, you know, but he was trying to figure out whatever it was. I figured it out. And so he thought, well, I'll tell other people how I figured it out and then they can do it too. And I did this and I did this and I did this. And one of these things was this, what the medieval Buddhists refer to as heroic thinking. I think it's really a nice way of putting it. Mm. Heroic thinking, thinking and applying, trying from every direction. And finally he made this breakthrough and he understood, oh, that's how it works, you know? And Pirro didn't have to go through all those stages because he met somebody who was a Buddhist teacher who gave him still the fairly early Buddhist ideas of it. He said, that's how it works, you know. And he went and formulated it very slightly differently, more or less the same way. And I think Hume, to some extent, redid it because he got this very kind of a crappy form of Pyrrhonism by reading encyclopedia articles. But he still, you know, got the basic idea anyway and reformulated it for his own purposes. And I think anybody can do that then. But it really does require a lot of heroic thinking and getting there, you know. But if somebody's done the work for you and you try and understand what they've done, that helps a lot. And I think that's so I'm just trying to do that, you know. But then at some point I thought, well, okay, if we get there and we get this and end up with this, and you say, okay, the circular thinking, according to the rectilinear logic, traditional logic is in fact circular. It's all circular, so it's all invalid according to traditional logic. But that means, gosh, doesn't that mean circular logic should be valid then? It must mean that. And that's the way we do think. All of our thinking is, in fact, is kind of non-rectilinear anyway, circular logic. What does that mean? I want to figure that out. I got as far as I could, and then I had to stop. I'm not a specialist in it, and I asked several people who I thought would be interested in it, but they're not really interested in it. So maybe somebody else will pick it up. That's kind of where I got to.
I've developed this kind of thinking in my own work. I don't know if that would be of any interest to you, but particularly the psychological basis of this kind of provisionality that I see is linked to Pirro.
Yes. Yes, you mentioned the psychological aspect, and I'm aware of the fact that there is the ethics, you know, that was one thing you mentioned. So Pirro's teachings are considered within the history of philosophy as by some people, and actually I'm not the first one by any means. There's some other important scholars, not like me, they're important, and who worked on Pirro and philosophy, early Greek philosophy and so on. And they said his teachings are, and actually the ancients, they mostly say he was an ethical teacher. But that doesn't mean necessarily our modern sense of ethics, that is a socially, sort of social idea pretty much. But it had to do with behavior and more like what you would say psychology is. So it was not a social teaching. Buddhist, you leave your family, right? That's an expression for it, to become a Buddhist, a practicing Buddhist. You leave the family. Well, then what do you mean? What does it mean when you leave the family? It means you leave society to some extent. You do join a kind of another group. Those are the other people who are doing the same thing. But I think in the beginning, there was no Sangha. So it was really leaving society and going beyond humanity, as I put in one of my chapter titles, in a certain way, to try and find that. And so who are you doing that for? Are you doing it for yourself? And so people criticize this later on. Later Buddhists, some of them criticize it as not being, you know, engaged enough with the society. And even in Megasthenes' account, there are these other two different basic varieties of Buddhists, of which then there are several apparently beginning to be some sects, different sectarian differences. But two basic differences are the ones who are kind of more doing the traditional thing, trying to achieve in the insights of the Buddha, and the others who are out there working to cure sick people and help them, you know, with different death rituals and things like that, practical work. So, I mean, that's the kind of people who I think would be criticizing the others, whereas the others would criticize them for not focusing enough on, you know, what it's all about is to try and understand how things, you know, not how things are, that's but how to understand, just basically how to understand, probably something like that. And what that can do for you when you understand is the result. But it's if you say that, then it's not good, because then you have this specific goal, which means you're not going to get there. So they never say it. Pirro doesn't say it. Never mentions it. It's Timon who says it.
But the implication is of a flexible practice in relation to it.
Yes. Yeah, I think so too.
Could you explain one thing which puzzled me, which was your references to normative Buddhism? I mean, what did you mean by normative Buddhism?
Sorry about that. I didn't really mean to say. Some people think that one reviewer said that when I use the word dogmatic somewhere, you know, about dogmatic beliefs, oh, he's being so critical, you know, and polemical. No, it was the ancients used this word dogmatic. Sextus Empiricus uses it to refer to certain non-skeptical beliefs, non-Pironian beliefs. So I didn't mean it in that way. I really just meant originally when I picked the term, it's normal Buddhism. It's the one that we know, you know, what we're familiar with from the canons, the Pali canon and the other canons, down to pretty much recent times. That's kind of, so it was normal, really, that probably would have been better. But normative is there too, because all of those forms of Buddhism are also normative. I don't know if you would exactly agree with me on it, but Buddhists are supposed to follow, have right mind and right practices and right this and right that and not wrong. You know, there's lists of these things in the different lists of Buddhist aspects of practice, the Four Noble Truths and the Eight Noble Truths. Eightfold Path and everything. There's all this, it is prescriptive, a lot of prescriptive stuff. And as long as it is there, that's normative, but that's not in, as far as I can tell, in early Buddhism. There's nothing like that. I mean, in the Buddhist teachings, in Pirro's teachings, as far as we can understand, as far as I've been able to get to them.
Well, in the broader sense that a philosopher would use normative, I think early Buddhism is normative. I mean, you make it clear that Pirro's teachings have, as we were you were saying just now, have moral implications. You know, it's part of a moral practice in one's whole life, which, you know, in ways that overlap with what we now discuss as psychology. So that was the puzzling aspect for me. I think that it seemed to imply that early Buddhism was not normative, which, in the broader sense in which I'm accustomed to using the word normative, it obviously is. But perhaps you had a particularly narrower sense in mind of the word.
Yes.
Normal would make more sense, I think.
Yes. Yeah. I also don't think that. Pirro is specifically said to have been non-normative, you might say, in that sense of your sense of the word, that he didn't prescribe and said you shouldn't have. He explicitly says, and as the Buddha is said to have said, and I think he must have, that you shouldn't have any beliefs.
Well,
don't have beliefs.
You should in that sentence, which is itself normative.
It's a normative sentence, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, in that sense, right. You're right. Yeah.
So it's not about specific moral rules necessarily. It's just about having a sense of should is normative.
Right. In that sense, of course. But of course, if Pirro were around and he was say, did you say that? You know, isn't that normative? That's Timon. I didn't say that. I didn't have anything to do with that.
If he was around, I get the sense that he would accept that there were values in his life which perhaps emerged from his experience.
Yes.
He didn't want dogmas to dictate his values.
That's exactly right.
He did have values.
And he was, again, it's the phenomena, right? In the phenomena world. And so he's living in the phenomena world, and we just live according to, you know, customs or whatever like that. That's what they all say. That's what he said and what the early Pyrrhonists did. So to some extent, then they accepted normativity, but as a part of the phenomena world. And the whole point is that it shouldn't be anything that should be taken beyond that to a meta level. To, you know, the reality, the real world, to the, you know, the perfect world and all these other ideas. As long as that's understood, then there's nothing wrong with that normative thing. But I think in the later Buddhism, which I refer to as normative Buddhism, that there is, in fact, this kind of appeal to perfectionism is there. I think that they adopted all sorts of things which Buddha rejected, just as most other religions. There are many other religions that they end up adopting stuff that's explicitly rejected by the founder. You know, Zoroastrianism, they took back some of those daivas. They couldn't live without those daivas, those other gods, you know, small g gods. So not just Ahura Mazda wasn't enough. So I think it's a typical thing for people to do. But yeah, I don't. See how there's a problem with it, insofar as long as you keep it within that the idea that it's part of the phenomenal world and doesn't go beyond that. So because we like to do that with our ethical ideas too, is to make sure that, you know, that those are ideal and they're perfections and so on. Shouldn't be any, I think. Yeah, but that's you're very right to point out that I don't make that clear anyway. That's for sure. Yes.
Well, anyway. It's been a great pleasure hearing you talk about your book, Chris, and thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Robert, for joining in the discussion too.
Thank you very much, and nice to meet you both, and nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.